You knew when Yom Kippur was?
Yes.
Right.
He even had a with Kol Nidre service with Da Chazan. We had Viva Lucky, we had Da Chazan with us. Moshe Rundel.
Now, you were liberated in Vaingen, right?
Yes. My cousin, Weisbrot, and my uncle, they marched out, evacuated the camp the week before towards Dachau. They still had another month of slavery, because that camp wasn't liberated until the war was over.
Oh, okay, so they weren't... So you didn't know if they were alive or not, right?
No, but after we got liberated, I went over to see when they transferred us from Vaingen to... Well, at first it was the French zone. When we stayed there in Vaingen, when they took us out from the barracks, the first thing they put us in was a castle. Right not too far from the camp was a castle. They took us out and cleaned us up and gave us some clothes, and they housed us in the castle. After that, they when the war ended, May 8, 1945, that zone became the American zone, and the American troops came in. And we had a high-ranking Jewish American officer came to see us, and he said, "That's very. These quarters are not very, very suitable for you." We stayed in that castle, and from the castle, they put us in the village right next. They expelled the Germans, and we stayed there in the village, and there wasn't much to eat. And I remember in the farmhouse, it was actually a farming community. There was a pig over there. We didn't get much rations, and they tried to figure out how to kill a pig, the Jewish people killing a pig. One says, "Well, he saw one time a Polak hit him over the head. So we stood around, we hit him over the head until we killed him." Then they said, "What do we do with the pig?" He said, "You got to pull him up, and string him up, and open him up." And we finally got some meat and cooked, and we had something to eat.
Now, when you were liberated, did you know that no one else in your family was alive?
At that point, we knew about Treblinka already, and what was happening in Auschwitz already. Yes, the Weisbrots, Teddy Weisbrot and his father, they were evacuated the week before towards Dachau. They didn't get liberated until later. When and the war ended, they divided up amongst the four powers, and that zone became the American zone.
How did you get clothing when you were liberated?
They just brought some clothes. They got them from the town. They just whatever. The army wasn't charged. Whatever they want, they just took. They didn't pay anything for it either. gave us some clothes, and then when it became the American zone after the war, it got a little bit better. We had a high-ranking Jewish American officer came to see us, and he says, "These quarters are really not suitable for you." He was in charge. He was already in Stuttgart. Stuttgart is the big town near Vaingen. It was the big town. He came to see us, and he was in charge of repatriating American troops back to the States, because the war was over already. And he says he's got, in Stuttgart, the troops are staying in apartment buildings. He's going to find other quarters for them, and he's going to take us out from this lousy place and house us over there. They had a large kitchen which was feeding the army. They were going to need the kitchen for us, and they took us over there. I wish I remember the name. It was a colonel or something.
Okay.
Stuttgart became a displaced persons camp, that people from other areas, when they got liberated, they heard about it. It was already established, and we were living in apartments. And after the war was over, I hopped at trucks and didn't have any transportation, and another truck, and until I got to Munich, I find out where they were evacuated to my uncle and Teddy and son were evacuated to Munich. So I went over there and they found them. They were alive. So
did you know they were there?
I did. Well, they evacuated the others except the sick ones. We stayed behind. So I figured if they are alive, they would be there. So they were there. So I told them about where we were living already. We already have apartments and much better quarters. So they came with me to Stuttgart. They stayed with us in Stuttgart. Then the uncle didn't know. He left the tante and the daughter. They were the only family which were intact after the war at Auschwitz, and he didn't know what happened to them. So he figured if they were alive, they would go back to our hometown. So he hopped some trains and trucks and went back to the hometown to Radom. And he found them over there. There were a few Jewish survivors who came back from the camps there. And they stayed in one house for safety reasons. And until the Polacks did one of their famous pogroms and killed one of them. So he took his wife and the daughter and told them we're going to Germany to the displaced persons camp.
Wait, so did you go back to Radom or no?
I did not, no.
You did not? So
I knew that my parents and sisters and brothers are no longer alive.
Now, do you have any photographs from before the war?
Yes, they're in my house here. The photographs with which we sent to our family here in the U.S.
Oh.
That was the only photographs he had.
Right. Okay. Do you know what happened to your house? You know, where you were living?
The apartment.
Yeah, the apartment, yeah.
Never went back. I never went back.
Right.
There was, we had a survivor friend, and he passed away a couple of years ago. New Jersey. He lived near Krakow, and his father had was a big businessman. He told me they had the biggest house in the town, and they had a mill on one side and a warehouse on the other side. And he went back to Poland and tried to get possession of the house. The government says, well, you don't live here. If you want possession of the house, you got to pay the taxes from all these years. So what he says, well, you rented the house. It's been rented all this time. You collected the rent. You could never get anything. He took them to court. For years and years, he hired a lawyer in Poland and took them to court. And finally, we told him, if you insist to get the house back, you got to come back and live in it over here. Otherwise, you don't get it back. So you still don't have it. He's dead already, and he's got a daughter in New Jersey. They still try to pursue it. It's no use with the Polacks.
Right. Okay. So then, where did you after they came back from Radom? Where did you go?
Well, we stayed in Stuttgart. That became a displaced person camp. We had housing. We had an apartment.
What was the housing like there?
It was a regular apartment building, and there was a communal kitchen. They had somebody cooking for us, but it's the same thing they did when there were U.S. troops over there. They cooked for them, so they cooked. We had meals over there prepared. The first thing I did. When I was liberated in Rheingen, we had a French chaplain. I had to go back to that. I forgot to mention that. When he came to visit us, when he asked, "Is anybody here has any relatives in the U.S. or Great Britain, the West?" I was the first one to raise my hand. do you have the addresses? I guess I was fortunate that my father did the correspondence with our relatives in the U.S., and he always gave me the envelopes to address them, because your handwriting is more legitimate. You don't understand better. So I kept remembering two addresses while I was in the camps. I kept repeating them every day. 4214 14th Street, Washington. And then 225 Beverly Street, Toronto, Canada. And when he came to Washington, he asked me, is it Washington, D.C. or Washington? I couldn't remember anymore whether it was D.C., so I said, well, send the letter to Toronto, Canada. That was my uncle, my mother's brother in Washington. It was my mother's sister. She had all her siblings in the U.S. and Canada, and three sisters and three brothers here. She was the only one left there. Bobby was with us, and there were immigration papers being made for us, but they didn't get finished enough. My aunt in Washington had already made a $5,000. They had to make a $5,000 deposit that the family would not be dependent on the state when they come here to the States. So she had made $5,000 deposit.
So how long were you in the DP camp for?
I was there. I was on not very long. I gave them the address in Washington and Toronto, and the French chaplain notified them that I was alive, so they got in touch with somebody. My cousin had a friend who was working for UNRWA, the Joint Distribution Committee. I can't remember which one. That was stationed in London, and he got in touch with the woman who was in charge. They sent us a person from the Joint Distribution Committee, and as soon as we were liberated, and he got in touch with her, so they got in touch with my family in Washington here. So
I mean, how many months do you think you were in the DP camp for?
I was on the first ship leaving Germany after the war to go to the U.S. I arrived in the U.S. May 20th, 1945, 46.
So you were in the DP camp?
We were liberated until I left to go to the...
So you must have been there several months, right?
Yeah, it was several months, yeah.
So what do you remember about the DP camp? Did you work there?
No, they didn't organize anything. They didn't organize anything at that time. When the war ended in May 1945, we stayed a while there in Weingen. Then the Jewish colonel moved us to Stuttgart to stay there in the apartments, and we stayed there in Stuttgart. I stayed there in Stuttgart until April 1946, until we shipped out. I was on the first ship leaving Bremerhaven to the U.S.
Good. Now, in the DP camp, did you do any black market?
Yes.
What kind of things did you... dealing.
Well, I befriended the Jewish service people. They had access to cigarettes. Cigarettes was a big thing. The Germans didn't have any access to cigarettes. It was a shortage of everything. I traded cigarettes for marks. They had two different marks. They had the German marks. The regular marks, I don't know, the different one was the Allied marks and the other marks. And it tried to, I remember I was in the black markets getting the cigarettes from the Jewish soldiers, then selling them for the marks. And I remember I bought a leather briefcase, like a businessman. And I had stuffed with one type of marks were better than the others. I think one was special marks for the Germans, and the other one was, I don't know, I can't remember anymore. I had a suitcase full of marks, and I wanted not the too good the marks, and I wanted to trade them for the better ones. So I took some money in my hand, and I walked into the bank with the bank like a big businessman, and asked to see the manager of the bank, and they ushered me into his office, and I shook my hand with him. I had the money to bribe him in my hand. Shake his hand, and he pocketed the money, and changed it from one mark, one type of marks, to the other mark.
Huh.
And a lot of people were dealing on the black market. Weiche and hard. Weiche is soft, which meant dollars. Hard ones make diamonds. used to go into black market with us.
Do you have any idea how much money you made?
No, I didn't. I had to stop very fast, because when my aunt in Washington asked the representative in London to get in touch with the representative in Reiningen to see what I need, so they're going to send me. So I told them I don't need anything, I have everything. So they figured out right away what I'm doing. So
right.
They sent a notice that says you better stop doing that. I was called in to the representative from the Joint Distribution Committee and says you have orders from your family. If you don't stop doing it, you get caught, you won't be able to go to the U.S. I had to stop in a hurry.
Right. What was your aunt's name?
Hannah Friedman. My mother's sister. She was the oldest sister.
Right. Okay.
So
and
I came to their house, and we it took us a month to sail from Bremerhaven to. Since it was the first ship, as we were leaving, they documented that on a little. In those days, when you went to the movie, you saw that little newsreel before the movie started. They documented the first refugees leaving Germany to the U.S.
Can you are you in the newsreel?
I don't know, but they took newsreels when our ship left Bremerhaven, and when we arrived.
What was the name of the ship?
Marine Pleasure.
So that was a military boat, right?
It was a transport, a military transport boat. I remember the people were so hungry, and the captain says to the cooks, he says, let them eat. As soon as the ship starts moving, they won't be eating anymore.
Right.
That was true. They were so hungry. Because when we got to Bremerhaven, to wait for the ship, nothing was organized. There was nothing to eat. They didn't give us anything. We didn't know what to do. So
did you speak English at the time?
No, I didn't know one word of English.
And how much money did you bring with you?
Well, I had to stop the black market in a hurry, because I was told they were preparing the papers for me to come to the States, and if I get caught, I won't be able to come. So I had about 20 English pounds and some dollars. I had to stop in a hurry.
And did you have under $100 with you?
Yes, but I don't know. I don't remember how many 20 pounds were worth.
Right.
I also had a little gold coin. I traded that for something. I don't forget what.
And how many suitcases did you bring?
No suitcases, just a briefcase.
Well, what was in the briefcase?
I can't remember. Not a whole lot.
Yeah. Did you come here with any of your other relatives on the boat, or were you by yourself?
I was by myself.
I mean, how come your uncle didn't go?
Well, it didn't have any papers right away. I came, and then there was a my cousin over there from Hennig in New York. When the soldiers came to visit us, one of the soldiers came to visit us over there in the camp. It was a cousin of his. So when he went back to the States, he made out papers for them. But for me, my family made out the papers right away. There was also some people, since we were in the first transport, my uncle and tante were not in the first transport. I think they were in the second or the third. The Jewish community in the States got after Harry Truman to establish a quota for the refugees. So there was a quota established for the refugees, those who didn't have any relatives. If they didn't have any relatives here, they went on the quota.
What do you remember about the trip?
Before the other organizations could organize, there were other prisoners there too, Goyim and French people. The Jewish organizations were right on the boat. They had everything ready before they filled the quarters with Jewish refugees right away.
Right.
So after I was. Well, we got sick on the boat, but there was a lot of singing. We had our chazan with us, so we always had songs. And when the boat got, we arrived, we couldn't pull into port because we came in there. It was nighttime, so the ship stayed, couldn't pull into the port at nighttime, so they stayed a little further away. And I went out on the deck and saw, I didn't know what it was. I saw so many headlights and taillights. I never saw so many cars moving back and forth on the bridges. It was a sight to see.
How many days were you on the ship?
It took us a month to sail from Bremerhaven to U.S.
Why did it take so long?
Well, it was a slow military transport. Didn't move very fast. I remember they had a special military band playing for us when our ship was leaving, since this was the first ship leaving, and it was recorded in the newsreel. It was a similar thing, a musical reception here when we came into New York. When we disembarked in New York, I had a reception committee. My aunt from Washington, her daughter, my cousin came, and also my mother's brother from Detroit came also. And they didn't know me, and I didn't know them. So they made a poster and held it up, the goat farm, so I would know when I get off the ship. I would know where to go to.
Right. Where did you arrive?
In New York.
Right. So did you see the Statue of Liberty?
No, I don't think so.
You don't remember?
No, I don't remember.
Okay.
We probably, when we disembarked, we got into a big, huge building. It must have been the place where all the immigrants were coming in for years.
Right, and was that an emotional meeting when you met your aunt and uncle?
But my uncle didn't come, just my aunt.
Oh, just your aunt? Okay.
And my cousin came.
What was your cousin's name?
Elizabeth.
Right.
Tante's name was Hannah. And we boarded the train to Washington, and we talked all the way from there to Washington, because I didn't know English, so I talked Yiddish. But to relate the story, and when we disembarked at the train station here at Union Station in Washington, my cousin Barbara, which was my second cousin, my cousin Elizabeth's daughter and her husband were waiting for us in a car. That was the first car ride I had.
Were you able to... What language were you talking to them in?
In Yiddish, that's all. Didn't know in English. And they took me back to Washington to my Tante Hannah's home, which was 42, 14 Street, Washington. That's the address I kept repeating every day in the camp. And also the one in Toronto, Canada. And so when I got there, it was already evening, and the whole family came together. I never saw so many cousins and getting together. So that was a big reunion.
Right. Now, how did you know for sure that nobody in your family was alive?
Well, at that time, we knew where they were taken, that they were taken to Treblinka. And one of the guys from the train, one of the engineers, came back one time and says, he transports the people there to Treblinka, but nobody comes out. So we knew already. We knew about it.
Right. Okay, so what happened when you went to Washington?
Well, I went to Americanization school for a while during the day, and then I figured I better do something, so I got a job doing something there. It was a tailor shop, so I got a job. That I knew a little bit about it to do something, but I didn't particularly care about it. So I left there and I went to work for a store. I figured I'm going to pick up some more English if I work in the store. And it was selling sheets and other stuff. I remember a customer came in looking for sheets, and I say shit, so I could, and I couldn't tell where it was until they pointed up to the on the shelf what they were looking for. So I had to learn, pick up some English words, and I worked there for a while. And
do you remember how much they paid you?
Very little. So it wasn't primarily to pick up some of the. I went to school also at night. They had an Americanization school to learn English. The Hispanics come here now, they don't go to school. We have to learn Hispanic. We went to at the beginning, I went to the Americanization day school. Then when I got the job, we went to school at night. And this is how we picked up some of the language. They didn't have any translators for us like they have now for the Hispanics and everything else. And we didn't demand anything. We were just glad to be here, to be alive, and to be in a free country.
Right. And you were living with...
I was living there in 1946.
Did you have your own room there?
Yeah, it was a regular house, and my uncle died on Shavuos in 1948, and in January 1949, I was drafted to the Army. You had to be either married or over 26 not to be drafted. So I was below that, not married, so I was drafted to the Army, and I was sent, after basic training, I was sent to Fort Bliss, Texas, for some further training. Fort Bliss is right on the border with Mexico.
Right.
In those days, you could cross the border, and nothing to do with the uniform, and I guess nonsense was different. They had drug wars over there. And the Army... I remember the first day, there was a guy over there. Everywhere I went, they assigned the bunks. He was right following me. They assigned the rifles. He was right with me. Every day he followed me. I didn't know anybody. I was the only Jewish guy there. And after a few days, he asked me, do you ever wonder why I follow you? I says, no, I'm glad to have somebody who wants to be with me. I don't know anybody here. So he says, I come from upstate New York, from a farming community. We never saw a Jew before.
Really?
The only thing I heard about Jews is from the traveling salesman passing by. You know what kind of stories they heard.
Right.
Became very good friends.
But what was his name?
I can't recall anymore. Although he came, there was one time he was traveling through Washington. He stopped. He was waiting on the bus there. So he called up our house to talk to me.
And where were you in the army?
I was in Fort Bliss, Texas, until I got a call from the Red Cross that they want me back in Washington on emergency leave. My tante is dying. So that was December. I went back for the funeral, and then when I came back to my post in the army, and the guy says, my next buddy from the next bunk says, I have all your belongings in the duffel bag, and we all shipping out. And half of us was assigned to go to Fort Benning, Georgia, and the other half, which is you, is assigned to go to Germany. So I went to the captain and says, I'm not going if it's at all possible. I don't want to go back to Germany. So he asked me the reason, so I told him. So he said, well, let me call up the headquarters and see if anything can be done. So he talked to the headquarters and said that the Secretary of Defense just came out. Since there's no war going on, they issued an order. Those who have completed half of their service. I was drafted, I think that at that time the draft was for 2 years. Those who have completed at least 1 year, which means half of the service, if they don't want to continue it, so they can get out into the reserves. So I says, that's me. So the captain asked me, they have two choices. You can either be active reserves or inactive. I says, I take the inactive. So that was January 1950, I had completed over a year of the service. So I got out, and I came back. I didn't have any place where to be because my tante had already died, and they gave up the house. So I had a cousin who was my uncle's son from Canada.
What was his name?
Chaim Blivas, same last name as my mother's. And he lived in Washington already. He came from Detroit to Washington to take over my uncle's dry cleaning business when my uncle Friedman died. And so when I came back, he lived over in there was an apartment over at the store, a two-bedroom apartment. And he had a little a boy already, it must have been about five or so, or six, and a small baby, and just born. The baby was in a crib in their bedroom, so I bought a cot, and a metal closet, and put it in the second bedroom with the other boy, and I stayed with them, and it wasn't long that the Korean War broke out in November 1950, which was just a few months after I got out. Since I was in the reserves, they called me right back.
Right.
But they didn't send me to Korea. They only sent me as far as Fort Meade, which is nearby here. Because they were bringing in troops to be trained, and I was already trained, so we were training the other troops until I completed the remainder of my service.
Okay, and then what happened?
I, I came back and went to work for Sears and Roebuck. Actually, it started in Sears and Roebuck before I went to the army. And so when I came back, I went back to Sears.
Where were you working for them?
Right here in Washington. They had several stores.
And what did you do?
I tried. There was another store over there, Heck Company, which had stores in Baltimore, which is owned now by May Company. I first went there to apply for a job, and the personnel officer interviewed me, like, said, "What kind of job do you want to do?" I said, "I want sales. I wanted to get out." And he interviewed me with a heavy accent. Said, "We'll call you. You know, one of those things. Never called." I had a cousin in Washington, my tante's son. He was working for Sears and Roebuck. He was in the advertising. So I called him up and says, "I need a job. I tried Tech Company. It's no go." So he says, he called up the manager of the store where he worked before he went into advertising. His name was Jacobs. He wasn't Jewish, actually, but he had a Jewish heart in him. He said he has a cousin. He just came over and gave him the whole story. He says, "Let him come over and meet me. Let him come over there tomorrow morning and meet me." I got dressed and came in. But the store opened up at 10 o'clock. Always in those days when you went for a job, you had a tie on and a jacket, not like they go now. And I asked somebody, Where's Mr. Jacobs? He says, "Oh, he's over there inspecting the store." So I walked over to him. And he says, "Oh, yes, go up on the fourth floor to my office and make yourself comfortable. When I finish here, I'll be up and we'll talk." So he came up. And we started talking. And he about the story here and there. And he asked me, "Where do you want to work?" So right away, I could have picked any job, but I says, "Well, I know something about clothes." So he put me in. "Well, you want to work somewhere else?" "No, let's try first here, because I don't know. I still wasn't that familiar with the language." He said, "So you called the personnel manager," and says, "put him to work right away." And something else he did, there was like a guy, I tried to recall his name, who came from Austria. He was working down in the basement in men's work clothes. He called him up, and he was actually a refugee from Austria. This store manager, Jacobs, met him. He was working in a big enterprise in Vienna. When the store manager went to visit the stores Vienna, see what they're doing over there business-wise, he met them over there. And then to escape the Nazis, he emigrated to the U.S., but he had a big problem with the accent. He just couldn't understand them very well. So he was looking for a job. But so he figured, in order for him, nobody would hire him, because he couldn't. Very tough accent. So he says, "Nobody wants to give me a job." So he says, "Well, I'm going to do something. Go to work in the warehouse first, Sears warehouse, and learn, get familiarized a little bit with the language, and then I'll bring you back here and give you a job here in the store," which was the proper thing to do. So when I came into the store, he had him already, he had brought him back already into the store, and he made him as a manager of men's work clothes. So when I first came into the job, he gave me a job in the clothing department. He also called him up and says, "Go down and see Harvey over there in the first floor, come up in the basement and make him feel comfortable." You know, he had a good heart in him.
Right.
So I worked there.
Do you remember how much money you made?
No, I can't recall. It was what, they didn't pay a whole lot. They didn't pay a whole lot, but I...
And where were you living?
I was living with my cousin, which he took over the store which my late uncle Friedman had, my tante's husband had, had a dry clean.
So what was your cousin's name?
Chaim Leibus.
Right.
Same name as my mother's last
name. And where was your,
My uncle died.
No, but what happened to your uncle, the one you were with in the camp? You know, the...
Weisberg?
Weisberg, yeah.
Well, they came from the... They came to New York. There was more work, you know, for his type of work, you know, he was an expert tailor in New York than it would have been in Washington. There was nothing in Washington here. So he stayed over there, and I went over there to see them when they first got there. They didn't have any quarters, and they had, I don't know, it was a small tiny whittly apartment, and I stayed, when I went to see them, I bunked with somebody else in the same bed, two people to a bed, so I went to see them, and then they got a larger apartment, and they came to see me in Washington, where I was stayed with my tante and uncle.
Oh, okay. So then you were working in Sears?
I was working in Sears, and I put in a lot of years. I put in the 41 years.
Wow. And now, did you get married then?
Yeah, I forgot about that.
I knew you, I was waiting for you to mention that. You kept forgetting about it.
Yeah.
So how did you meet your wife?
Well, there was some, you know, they tried to keep together, but the refugees people always stuck together. There was a refugee girl who came in. I was the first one to arrive in the States, and she was right after me. She had an uncle living right around the corner where I was staying with my tante on the next street. Her name was Nina Schuster. Her uncle's name was Miller.
Right.
He used to have a grocery store, and at that time he had a liquor store business. And they had a basement rec room that we used to get over there. So we used to go over there. Whichever refugee boy or girl came, we always used to meet. We used to stick together. And my future wife came. She was younger than I am, but 6 or 7 years younger. She came. She and her mother. She was not in the camp. She was in the partisans. And they were trying to make to go to Palestine, and her mother got sick at one time, and then when they were supposed to get on the boat, which became the Exodus. You remember the Exodus?
Yep.
Boat? But the truck broke down, so never made it, and then they figured they better come to the U.S. They had her late father's sister and her husband lived in Washington. So she and her mother came to Washington, and the refugees' kids always looked up. My cousin, my tante's son, worked in a wholesale grocery store. And at that time, the Jewish merchants here had small grocery stores. They didn't have those huge grocery stores. And they went to get they always went to the wholesaler to get the grocery. And my cousin over there could always let me know that a refugee girl came in, this so-and-so grocery man had a refugee boy came, so we got together.
What did they call it? They didn't call it a refugee person. What did they call it, a greener, or what did they...
Greener, yeah. Another greener is Kim.
Right.
So we always stuck together. Used to sing songs together and whatever so-called entertainment.
Right. So her name was, you said Nina?
Nina Schuster. Now she's married to somebody from, she lives in this, still lives here in Washington. Somebody from Lodz. It used to be Kushmirek, but they changed it to Merrick.
So how long did you go out with her for?
I didn't go out with her. I never went out.
Oh, you never went out with her?
No, we just get it together. They had a rec room in the basement in her uncle's place where she was staying. We always used to go over there in the evenings.
So how did you meet your wife?
When she came into the States, her uncle had a grocery store also. My cousin, he worked for the wholesaler, so when the grocery merchant went there, he always let him know if there are any Jewish refugee boys or refugee girls. So we met at one time, and it didn't click off. She was still young, and I don't know. But I went to the Army. When I came back from the Army, we had another get together, and I had a Landsman, you know who a Landsman is?
Yeah.
Also a survivor. He tells me a story that he tried to call up her maiden name was Mother Pearl.
Right.
Not Pearl Mother, but Mother Pearl. He called her up, he wanted to take her out to dinner and a show, and she wouldn't go out with him. I said she wouldn't. I said she'll go out with me. And just I call up. And no problem. I said she. so we went out and I think it happened to be on the day which.